SQPN.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Where to begin?
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Secrets of the Hobbit, the podcast that is entirely dedicated to the Hobbit books, the world of Tolkien, all the backstory, the lore, the mythology that Tolkien used to spin his stories. But we also follow the latest news from New Zealand, where two movies are being produced right now as we speak by Peter Jackson, the producer and director of the Lord of the Rings movies, and he now turns his attention and his energy to the story of The Hobbit. And to talk with me about the latest news and about the ancient lore of Middle-earth is Dave Kale. Good morning, Dave.
Hello, Father. How are you, sir?
I am good, and I'm excited to talk about The Hobbit again. We have a little bit of news. It's not always a very news-intensive time when we record, but I'm glad to see a couple of bullet points on our show notes here to talk about. And today, we are also going to begin our close reading of The Hobbit book. And we'll take our time to do this. After all, we still have about a year before the movie comes out, so we don't want to rush anything. But I enjoyed going back to the book and start reading. Actually, the first chapter is the chapter that I know best because I've read it so many times, and it comes back in so many articles about The Hobbit as well. But it's actually fun to just step into the story, and I don't know about you, but once I started rereading it, there were a number of things that struck me, and I immediately had a list of questions that I want to ask you, because you're the real expert here, and things that I never noticed before. And perhaps it's because we've seen all these pictures, and I have a much clearer mental image now of how to imagine the Shire, how to imagine the situation, the dwarves, and so I see other things now that I'm rereading this. So looking forward to talk with you about this first chapter and do a first cursory look at the story, at the characters, and some of the questions. And then I might actually go back next time that we have a recording and read up on the genesis of the first chapter in the history of the Hobbit that I'm also reading. I wasn't able to finish all the backstory, because the book actually treats the genesis in a way that they start talking about the entire first draft, and then they go back to the first chapter, and then they talk about the second all the changes that were made, and then oftentimes it treats themes, so it doesn't go through the books chapter by chapter, so it's kind of difficult to gather all the information.
So you're gonna have to read the whole thing and then synthesize it.
Yeah, but that's kind of that's problematic, because we're talking more than 1,000 pages here, so I'll probably just jump through the book and try to scrape together as much as much information as I can as I can find. But what I've read so far is already fascinating in terms of the way the story changed over time, and mm-hmm. We'll bring that up when we analyze our first chapter of The Hobbit. But first of all, I want to take a look at the big news from New Zealand.
Confounded old Samwise Gamgee! Have you been eavesdropping?
I haven't dropped no eaves, sir, honest.
What did you hear? Speak!
Nothing important. Please, Mr. Gandalf, sir, don't hurt me. Don't turn me into anything unnatural.
So what have we heard in New Zealand? Filming is starting soon. So they've had this break between the first couple of months of shooting, and then there was this break. We've seen this in the production video with Peter Jackson, and so they took time to do some post-production and rewriting of the script and some location scouting in preparation for the next phase of actual shooting with the actors. And so we know that a couple of our big name actors are there. Luke Evans, the Bart de Bowman, is already in New Zealand. Stephen Fry is there. Both of them have to do with the part of the story that takes place in and around Lake Town. And so there are some new location rumors about where they might go next. And this will not just be inside the studios in Wellington. They are actually going on location now in New Zealand. So what have you heard?
You know, I'm surprised that there aren't more of these rumors, because, you know, especially this time around filming this, the Kiwis must just be on the lookout for, like, even the faintest hint of a Hobbit person strolling down their street saying, oh, they're going to film here. So coming out of New Zealand, out of Wellington, by our friend Jack M., who is Lord of the Rings tour guide there, and he runs the New Zealand Noldor blogs. That's nznoldor.com. He's probably one of the best sources of news out of unofficial news out of New Zealand, by the way, because he's the guy that released the photos from the highway and stuff.
So. Oh, that was his photo with the set piece on the back of a truck?
On the back of the trail. Yes. Yeah. So he's an excellent source of unofficial news. Anyway, what he's reported is he heard from somebody he refers to as a spy, so a friend in New Zealand that's on the lookout for these things. Who's spending the winter in the beautiful Waitaki Valley, I'm sure I mispronounced that, who has heard rumors in that area that a big movie, quote-unquote, is being filmed somewhere between the towns of Duntroon and Kuro along the Waitaki River.
All right.
Which is very interesting. Assuming she's not making it up or isn't hearing, false rumors planted by Peter Jackson, that's pretty indicative. Along the river seems to be that can really only be about one thing.
Now, what do you think it is? Because I was a bit confused. It's like, what are they going to film here?
Well, my guess would be the scenes from Barrels Out of Bond through everything that takes place in Esgaroth, otherwise known as Lake Town. So that would be the chapters. Barrels Out of Bond is the chapter that they escape from the Elven King's dungeons, where Bilbo locks the dwarves in the empty wine barrels that are being floated down the river to Lake Town to be refilled.
So this big river could be like the river that they float on in their barrels, and wasn't it supposed to be a small river? Because this one looks, I'm using Google Earth, and I just typed in Duntroon, New Zealand, and I had to add New Zealand because apparently there's also a Duntroon in Canada. Who would have known? You'd think that a name like that only exists in one place on Earth, and this is a huge river, and it's partially dry, and so it's kind of a mixture of water and then mud, as far as I can tell. It looks very remote and wild. There's some mountains in the background. Now, that could, of course, be very appropriate, because we know that Lake Town itself is surrounded by, well, of course, you've got the Lonely Mountain, but it should be a mountainous region.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, that doesn't say much, because they can always put in the mountains afterwards using CGI. Now, I'm looking at a photo that was taken halfway between these two towns, Duntroon and Kuro, and we're talking like small villages. Duntroon has 114 inhabitants, or perhaps 115 or 113. You never know exactly who dies and who is born in the meantime. Kuro has 339 people. And I'm looking at a photo of the Otiaki River in flood. And it looks really strange. It's almost like a swamp type of water. The color of the water is actually almost yellow because of all the mud, and the grassland surrounding it is entirely brown. And I don't know exactly what the season is during which they took this picture. And in the background, you see these beautiful mountains. It's a bit misty. So actually, the mountains are pretty far away from the river itself. Now, of course, they can always use zoom lenses, etc., to make the mountains appear bigger and use all sorts of trickery. But this is not the kind of river that I imagined reading those chapters. But perhaps you're right. Perhaps this is the river that leads to the lake.
Well, another thing, especially on some of the wider and deeper parts, it's possible that maybe they won't necessarily use this for the barrels out of bond part, but if they can find a wide enough part, they can use it for just the scenes where the barrels arrive in Lake Town. So they use it sort of at the part where the river meets the lake and where Lake Town is actually located. And that is Jack's speculation. That perhaps this is they're shooting Lake Town. When you couple that with the fact that Luke Evans, who's playing Bard the Bowman, and mm-hmm. Stephen Fry, who's playing the Master of Lake Town, have just happened to arrive in New Zealand recently, and now they're scouting this watery location, or so rumors say. People are wondering, oh, so maybe they're filming the Lake Town scene soon.
Could be. Yeah, or at least it's true what you say. Perhaps they're just filming one aspect of Lake Town. Because the thing that threw me off was, of course, I was zooming in and out over that location in Google Earth. And I was like, there is no lake. It's just a river. So this won't work for Lake Town. But then I'm like, well, that's dumb. Of course, they can film the lake and Lake Town somewhere totally different. They're not tied to one location for that. They can film one scene here and then go cross country and do the rest in a totally different place and in a different time, actually.
Yep, that's totally true. I would add the caveat that Jack himself mentions on his blog that he has previously reported on rumors of Hobbit sets being constructed and sites being scouted that turned out to be not Hobbit related, but other films being filmed. So these could be completely unsubstantiated. Well, they are unsubstantiated, and we could be completely wrong. But by all means, let's continue spinning the rumor mill.
Absolutely. By the way, I'm wrong now. I have a little bit more. In Google Earth, you see more than on Google Maps. And on his website, there is a small Google Maps, and I thought it was just a river. But actually, up north, to the northwest of this big, long river, is something that looks like a lake. It's a Lake Aviemore. Aviemore, I'm not sure how to pronounce this in the local way. And it's kind of a long, elongated lake, also surrounded by mountains on both ends. It's not exactly the type of lake that I imagine Lake Town to be at, but it definitely has this, it looks like a lake, depending from where you shoot it. So this could also be... the combination could actually work. And it's just if you just go there, just type this in Google Earth and look at the pictures that have been posted there. Not that many pictures, so I guess it's a pretty remote area, because normally if you go, for instance, to Wellington, I mean, Google Earth is just scattered with thousands of photos on every street corner. Whereas here you only have a few photos posted by tourists, of course, because the Google Earth works with these GPS coordinates. So if you upload a photo to, I guess that should be the Google Photo Service that they have, they will use that in Google Earth, I think, if you allow them to. And so I'm looking at this fantastic photo of Lake Benmore, which is a part of that same. This is the same stream. I guess this is where the water starts, and then it flows down to the south through the river. And this is a spectacular photo of a lake, Lake Benmore, but very remote. So this could be part. I don't know. We've seen in the third production video some footage of them flying in a helicopter and also landing in a very remote spot where there was lots of snow, and it was breathtaking, but I don't think that they told us where that was. So it might have been here. Well, there's even a YouTube video here, but it's aqua biking at Black Forest Station. That's probably something we will not see in Middle Earth. I think we can be sure of that. But anyway, it's fantastic to see these beautiful photos. It makes me want to go to New Zealand and see this with my own eyes.
I totally agree.
Who knows? So that was one location. So perhaps for the river scenes with the barrels and then part of Lake Town, there was a second rumor, wasn't it? Wasn't there?
Yeah, this one's maybe not quite as easy to speculate about. At least Jack didn't. He just mentioned some scouting. But Wednesday he posted about another two possible locations. As he puts it, I've heard two interesting but fairly non-specific location rumors. He says some locals from, oh dear, Te Anau, it's T-E-A-N-A-U, are reporting that some quote-unquote hobbit people are putting their feelers out for mass accommodation in that area for late November, early December 2011. So they're thinking about whether they can bring the whole cast and crew there and do some filming in late 2011. And then the second thing that they mention is apparently there's quote-unquote something large, a movie set-related thing, being set up near the town of Middlemarch, inland from Dunedin. I love the fact that there's a town that is one letter removed from the word Dunedin.
Yeah, that's
excellent.
Crazy. That's crazy.
Yes. And so he says the indications he's getting are that these are Hobbit-related. He doesn't mention what those indications are or why he's convinced that this is Hobbit-related, but it sounds very interesting. I mean, it seems, especially since they really are filming at this point, it seems like if anyone's setting up anything huge, it's highly likely to be Hobbit-related. So Jack doesn't speculate on what those locations might be, and I don't have any good thoughts. Oh. I think Te Anau has a lake near it, a large lake, actually.
Yes, actually, I'm zooming in right now. And I'm looking at Dunedin is all the way in the south of the southern island, and yes, there is a big lake.
There's a good chance we might be looking at Lake Town.
That you might be right, and it opens up in the sea. Actually, there's a port on the eastern side. And let me look at a photo from down below.
Well, I found a photo of a dock sitting, you know, like a wooden dock extending off the coast into the lake. And looking at that, that really makes me think of Lake Town because Lake Town is built largely on the actual lake. It's connected to the coast to the shore, but it actually extends out into the lake, and it's an entirely wooden town that's essentially built on the surface of the lake. You know, they did that to get away from Smaug, and so they're gonna need that's gonna be a huge undertaking to recreate that. Now maybe they'll be fancy with special effects and they'll just film a wooden set on land and then transpose it onto some water.
Just
but
add
it would
some
be
water.
Super cool if they actually built it on the lake.
Who knows? I mean, they've done this amazing location. Where was that for the second movie? The in the plains of Rohan.
Mm-hmm.
And they built this small town on top of that lone hill. Remember that one?
Yes.
It looked fantastic. It was a very, very detailed set, and it looked as if it belonged there. And so they spent months building that up, and
that would be awesome if they did that here.
I wouldn't be surprised since they have a bigger budget now. Why not? The photos of this lake are spectacular too, especially the ones taken during sunset. The only difference with the other lake that I was referring to, more up north, is that this one, the mountains surrounding this one, are much lower. They look like hills and not like mountains. So, but perhaps they need that in order to make the lonely mountain kind of stand out. So you don't want the lonely mountain to be surrounded by other huge, huge mountains, because then the effect would be less impressive.
Yeah, that's going to be the most interesting part, I think. That's going to require some work on their part, I imagine.
But the lonely mountain is going to be CGI, at least, from what I saw, or a painting, or because they were, I think, talking about the sketches. I forgot if it was in one of those production videos or if I read that in an article, but they had the artists working on the Lonely Mountain and on the looks of that. Another interesting detail here on the site, I'm reading NZ Noldor here, is that the Waitaki River is not far from the city, the town of Twizzle. And Twizzle was used, or at least the area around Twizzle was used, for the Lord of the Rings Pelennor field battles. So it has these big open fields. And so Peter Jackson is probably already familiar with the location. He knows people there. They've already worked there, and that always helps. If you want to work quickly, you want to have, of course, he always needs to ask permissions to film, because it's like almost the entirety of New Zealand is just a national park. And the Kiwis are extremely fond of their country and protective. And so we heard these early rumors months ago that there were objections from the native population against Peter Jackson's ideas to film in certain parts, you know, near certain mountains, because those mountains were considered to be holy and sacred. And so I can imagine that if they already negotiated the rights to film for The Lord of the Rings, then it would be much easier to renegotiate those rights for The Hobbit than if you go to a totally different region where there might be, you know, another political situation.
Yeah, I agree.
So, and I guess even in terms of organizing the whole production, I mean, we're talking about moving so many people and so much equipment. It helps if you still have all the addresses and the phone numbers and just even the local restaurants, you know, that can provide you with food and shelter. That's the kind of stuff that you can save a lot of money on if you go to an area that you already are familiar with.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's what the Hobbit people putting out the feelers are trying to negotiate. It sounds like this is going to be this is a potential location for bringing like everybody, like a lot of people.
Right.
So this is going to be a significant scene, and I imagine they'll be there for a while.
So it has to be Lake Town. I mean, that's really important.
Yeah, I kind of agree, because they have to shoot a lot of scenes, and they have to do some really significant scenes like Smaug's attack on the town and things like that.
Yes, and potentially even backstory mythology stuff, because of course when I was reading the first chapter, that was the first thing that struck me, that they already talk about what happened there in that area, and so we might see that in a flashback when they're telling the story, or singing actually part of the history. I can imagine that they might want to film that as well to illustrate it and to get us to introduce us to Smaug already in the area of Lake Town, so that when we see it later on in the second movie, we're already familiar with them. And I don't know, it creates a bit more visual continuity between the first and the second movie.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that makes sense. That's a lot to film. They go there towards the end of the year. Was that the rumor? So towards is it like November?
Yeah, it was late November, early December 2011. So it sounds like it would be maybe for a month of shooting between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Right. That indicates that
they probably won't be celebrating Thanksgiving, but
No. Actually, they might have a totally different date for that.
Yes.
Just like in Canada. But I think that that's springtime, or the beginning of springtime. So you might still have snow on the mountains, at least the higher mountains. But at the same time, the weather is much more stable than around this time, where it's really, the weather can be nasty in New Zealand, and it can snow and rain, and you don't want conditions like that unless you control them. Especially not for an expensive 3D production as this one. Hey, speaking of which, just a small excursion to something unrelated, except for the 3D. I finally got to see the last Harry Potter installment in 3D. And they even had moving hydraulic chairs, hydraulic seats in my theater.
Wow.
That was pretty cool. But the 3D, I was underwhelmed. This is the first time that I saw a 3D movie where I didn't think it worked. And it actually was a bit off-putting. I was like, I don't like this kind of 3D. When I put on the glasses, everything became a bit drab and dark. And it was just no sparkle in the image. Which made me again question this whole 3D plan for The Hobbit. I hope they do a good job. And another thing was that I noticed was that, and that could be the difference with what Peter Jackson is going to bring us, the 3D with the conventional projection here in Amersfoort in the Netherlands, that was a 24 frames per second movie. Mm-hmm. And whenever you've got like fast movement, I got disoriented because the camera moves, but it's kind of choppy because you only have 24 frames, which is kind of slow. And then you add to that kind of really strange 3D, and you don't know, especially in like a special effects laden movie, it's kind of hard to understand what's going on the screen. And I didn't like it at all. And then, you know, my seat was shaking in all directions. It wasn't a good experience. So perhaps the 3D combined with the 48 frames per second might work better. But
I'm skeptical.
I'm starting to hope that they will also have a 2D version that I can watch, because it might be so much more comfortable.
Yeah, I find the 3D distracting as much as, you know, like it just doesn't add that much, in my opinion.
No.
There are very few cases where I watch it and I'm like really enjoying it.
The only movie that I watched that really convinced me that 3D can be cool was Avatar. Because it was non-obtrusive. I love the flying scenes in there. But a lot of the movement in that movie is kind of slow. And so you know where you are, and it's not jarring, and there's nothing coming out of the screen. That's another advantage of what Avatar did. So it's more like you're looking through a window, which is much easier to process than, for instance, I watched a Beowulf in 3D. You know that CGI movie?
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible, because every 5 minutes they would stick something in your eye, like a spear, or someone would jump out of the screen.
That's my favorite part of the 3D.
I don't like that at all. Anyway, so
it's like,
yes,
that old the old it's like the, have you ever been to you must have been to Disney World or Disneyland,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and Universal
and you saw
Studios.
The 3D things there, right?
Oh gosh. I still remember the 3D Terminator ride that they have over in LA in Universal,
uh-huh,
Studios. Did you ever take that ride?
No, I haven't done that one.
It's kind of a blend between regular theater, so you've got actors, you actually have robots and on the stage, and
mm-hmm,
then all of a sudden the curtains go up and you see these three screens, huge screens, like IMAX size screens, and it's all in 3D. And then there's this fluid metal droid that is literally poking like metal bars in your eye. It's
mm-hmm,
ugh. It was so weird. It's really nauseating, but and then with they did that with the Muppet Show, and I don't know, it never works for me during rides. It's perhaps because I'm too old. I don't know. Let's get back to The Hobbit. I might actually be a bit of a movie theater hobbit. I like my things to be conventional and not too exciting.
Yes.
Oh,
you do
God.
Sound a bit like a movie theater hobbit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I never thought I would become one, because as a kid, I loved this the more 3D and the more my seat moves, the cooler it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure for The Hobbit. I want to focus on the story. It's a serious movie. It's a serious story. So I don't like too many gimmicks. Anyway, all that because the last, I love that last Harry Potter installment in terms of acting, and the overall balance of the movie was great. But you know,
mm-hmm,
this is the first time that I really thought that the 3D was redundant and just added because everybody does 3D nowadays. Oh well.
Yeah.
What is this story about this super fan awaiting the Hobbit's return to the Shire? This is a guy called Ian Brody, and
yeah, that's what I've read. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, he works in Matamata. Is that what I? Is he involved in the tours that are given on the farm, the actual farm where the Shire is located, the Shire set?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he seems to have some kind of inside information or a relationship with the people filming. So, for example, he says that he's seen the entire rebuild of Hobbiton, of the Hobbiton set,
right.
And he's even gotten to photograph it. you know, as a part of his so-called day job. But, you know, basically he works 9 to 5 for Alexander's Farm in Matamata. And yes. He does a lot of like guides and tourism and things like that. I think there he publishes travel guides.
To the article here, he is the Hobbiton Movie Set and Farm Tourist Media and Communications Manager. That's a pretty long job description.
Fantastic job description.
He must be the guy that owns the company that I actually used when I was visiting Matamata, and they take you in these small cars, these buses, to the actual farm. Because the funny thing is, and not many people realize that the entire Hobbit set was built on a farm, an existing farm, and it's actually, even when they were filming The Lord of the Rings and in between, the years in between the trilogy and the new Hobbit movies, that location has been in use as a regular sheep farm. So there are just, you know, right in front of the Hobbit holes, you've got sheep, real sheep, not like stunt sheep or or animatronics, but it just feels like a living, breathing country location, which it is. And so it adds, I think that's why the Shire and Hobbiton look so realistic on in The Lord of the Rings, because it feels like those Hobbit holes have been there forever. And then, of course, not to mention the big party tree that's in the center, not far from the hills, and there's this small lake that they used. When I went there 2 years ago, and they had just started to build up the set, you know, planting apple trees, and I don't know, there was a lot of like early construction going on. But it just felt as if the hobbits had just left for vacation or something like that, and they could be back anytime, because it was just such a living, breathing environment. And I guess the guy, this Mr. Brody, must just work there and helping the family that owns this enormous area there, because it's much bigger than the actual set. We're talking tons and tons of miles in all directions. They will probably help the farm kind of manage this and make money off this and make sure that the farm life can continue.
Yeah, he's basically their consultant to help them manage the tourists.
That must be it.
Awesome.
I was surprised because I think I share this in when I'm actually doing the tour. I recorded the whole thing, and in a couple of weeks I want to start putting those episodes online, because it's fascinating to just go there and hear the sounds and hear the explanation of the tour guide. The thing that amazed me was how simple it was in terms of organization. There was just this small company, the town itself, Matamata. Well, there is a statuette of Gollum, and there's like a sign that says this is Hobbiton, and that's about it. And I expected something very polished, like what the stuff that you see at Universal in Disneyland, where they would just capitalize on this location as a tourist magnet. And there were a couple of tourists there, but you know, the just the fact that they were still tending to their sheep there, and there was actually a demonstration where I got to, you know, feed the lambs and everything, and it was just a couple of meters away from the Hobbit set. And so I just couldn't believe it. There was there was a little tiny little souvenir shop when you came back in Matamata. And so you could buy a t-shirt and, I don't know, perhaps a couple of souvenirs. But it was tiny. You could fit like...
Sounds like they're not capitalizing.
I don't know. It's very remote, I have to say. So it's not that, you know, you arrive in New Zealand and there's a bus or any taxi will bring you straight to the Hobbit set. It's not like that. You have to... We traveled from Auckland for 2.5 hours, I think, through the countryside. And so this is really remote. So that might keep tourists from going there. But it was just a shocker, because you arrive there and you're like, oh, I'm in the Shire. I couldn't believe it. I would pay hundreds, if not thousands of bucks just to be there and walk around and pretend that I'm a hobbit. But apparently it's kind of low-key, the whole organization. I wonder if that will change in the future, though, because I totally think there's a huge market for a hobbit theme park. And if they're wise, they will do it there.
Yeah, that's true. Although I don't know, I wonder if the folks who own the rights will let them get away with it. But yes, you would think they would do something.
I don't know.
I don't know. Don't they all want to make some money? It's yeah, not that Tolkien is going to write any new books anytime soon. So you got to keep the family going, right? But I read in the article that this Mr. Brody also wrote that location guidebook. And now I want to know if that's the same book that I have here. So I'm going to step to my, I'm going to take a look at my bookshelves here.
Yeah, go grab it. Because he's written a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. It says that, and it's amazing. I guess apparently he went and pitched the book to HarperCollins when he first was writing his Lord of the Rings location guidebook.
Okay.
And apparently they HarperCollins said, "Nah, we were only going to do 15 books on the Lord of the Rings about the movie, and they're all done, so we're not doing any more." And finally, he convinced them to let him publish this one, or to publish it for him. And they only published 15,000 copies, thinking it would be small. And those sold that there would be very small sales. That they figured that'd be good enough for 2 years. Uh-huh. And those sold out in 3 days. And
no
they have
way.
Ended up having to publish over 370,000.
Fantastic.
Now, good for him.
I have the, the third print. So it was first published in 2002, and it was reprinted the same year twice. And I've got the third batch. And this was given to me, actually, when I visited New Zealand. And what makes this location guidebook, and it's really small. It's like, 95 pages. What makes it cool is that they show you the photos of the various locations in New Zealand, maps, very detailed maps of the mostly the Southern Island, and then they show you in inserts small photos of the actual movie. So that's probably why New Line and HarperCollins had to be involved, because then you get the whole thing about the rights and using the logo and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really cool to see the before and after photos of this. This is what the place really looks like, and this is how it looks this is what it looks like in the movie. And it's interesting because with these maps you can actually see that they went all over the place for areas that in the movie seem to be very close to each other or even in the same location are in actuality very very remote and very far one from another. So but this might be an interesting booklet also to consult and to read through again might reuse certain locations.
Well, they were mentioning that the Lake Town location we were discussing along the is it the Lake Town location?
Or was
we
it the river?
Discussing?
The river one?
No, it's Te Anau, I think, is actually near where they filmed the Battle of the Pelennor Fields.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I mentioned earlier on. Near that town. Yes. So makes sense that they might revisit some of those locations.
Yeah.
We should get some Kiwis on the show to talk about their own country. Why are we talking about New Zealand? We don't know nothing about New Zealand.
I totally agree.
Here's our call. If you are a Kiwi and you're listening to this show, I don't know why, because you probably know much more about the whole Hobbit production than we do. But if you want to come on the show and you have some news to share, or you can tell us something about the areas where they are filming or where they filmed The Lord of the Rings, we would love to have you on the show. So just send us a note to tolkien@sqpn.com or get in touch with us via our Facebook page or via Twitter. And we'll see what we can do. And of course, we'll use our own contacts as well to see if we can get some Kiwis here on the show. I think it's time, after these location discussions, to step into the story. Let's do a final wrap up. Is there anything else concerning the actual filming?
I don't see any
news
that's really worth getting into.
Yeah, there's just James Nesbitt. Who's one of the dwarves, right? Is he, who does he play? Is he the fat?
I don't recall. I can't keep them straight.
He is, I think he toured New Zealand with some foodie or something like that. And it's the article is all about
food. There's
a
lady in Wellington who's doing a blog called 17 Days, 17 Dates. It's actually a Tumblr site. And and she's just going out on a going and having dinner with somebody at some restaurant. And then she rates the date and the restaurant. Actually, it looks specifically like it's burgers. And so she went and had dinner with James Nesbitt one evening.
He's Beaufort. So,
yeah, that's right.
They went well. Anyway, it could be. It's kind of funny because that's the first thing that dwarves do when they enter Bilbo's house. It's eating, eating some more, and then eating some more. there was also this is all the tiny stuff that is hardly worth mentioning. But Stephen Fry visited the Wellington Zoo and got face to face with the famous penguin, Happy Feet. You know, the penguin that ended up in New Zealand and was starting to eat sand because he thought it was snow, and so they're bringing him back to his natural habitat now. But before that, he got to meet the famous Stephen Fry.
Good for him.
Yeah, very good. And there are some tidbits that we might talk about when towards the end of the show if we have some time. But let's start with our analysis of the story.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. This is wonderful.
I meant to go back, wander the paths of Mirkwood, visit Lake Town, see the Lonely Mountain again. But age, it seems, has finally caught up with me.
You hear the tookish side of Bilbo, you know, when he reminisces about Lake Town and about the Lonely Mountain and all the adventures that he had. And when the story begins, he is all but a took. And so how are we going to tackle this? I don't have the text in front of me because I'm reading it on my iPad, and I use the iPad also for all
the
jingles.
iPad to produce the show, yes.
Exactly, so I can't go back to
it. I do have my text in front of me.
All right.
You said you had things you wanted to ask or discuss, you know, like if you had certain thoughts that you wanted to jump right into, by all means, go for it. But otherwise,
well, it's a bit hodgepodge in terms of thoughts. I didn't do a paragraph or by paragraph analysis and with notes and stuff. But I do have a couple of things that I remember while reading it. And the first thing that struck me was that there is an interesting parallel between what happens to Bilbo and the story that we hear about how the dwarves got involved in this whole, you know, quest for the treasure thing. And in every story, you need to have a starting situation, and then there needs to be a call to adventure. This is kind of part of the framework that you find in almost any story. This is there's this whole it's almost like the skeleton of every good story. There you have a given situation, and then something happens that is unexpected, and or someone enters your life that will actually try to get the hero to move from the from the current situation to the adventure. And so in this case, of course, it is Gandalf and the dwarves that form this call to adventure. But what I love about the way that Tolkien begins the story is by establishing you know, all is well for Bilbo. And he has this reputation for being super predictable. Like, you can ask, before you ask a question to Baggins, you already know what the Hobbit is going to say. That's how predictable they are. And he's super comfortable. He's got the nicest house in Hobbiton. And apparently his parents were very rich, or his mother was. And then his dad actually constructed this bag end with her money, or partially with her money. And it's so abundant and it's so comfortable that there's really no need to move, literally. You don't want to go anywhere because, you know, you're super comfortable. And so the interesting thing is that how are you going to move this Hobbit? Well, there is a little bit of a kind of our genes. There is a kind of a predisposition to adventure because of way back in the past that everybody has forgotten about. There is this tookish side that and there are some stories about strange adventures and something out of the ordinary. But when the story starts, Bilbo is just anything that a hobbit should be according to the conventions. And then the big changes, of course, is this totally wacky story about a dragon and a treasure, and you've got a wizard knocking on his door, and then 13 dwarves. I mean, it's just totally over the top. This is not just a very gradual introduction into the adventure. His life changes from one second to another. The moment that Gandalf knocks on his door, his life takes a 180 degree turn. And so it's almost
and what's really fascinating is not only does his life change, but he changes or mm-hmm. maybe he's not really changing inwardly, because maybe this was always in him, this sort of tookish, adventurous side. And at the end of the story, it comes full circle, and it's sort of the good common sense Baggins hobbit side of him that helps resolve situations. But
it comes back.
What's interesting is he outwardly anyway changes as the story goes. His life changes, and in turn he also changes as a person.
But the interesting thing is that here in the first chapter, he mm-hmm. doesn't seem to be ready for the adventure at all. And yet the call to adventure is one thing. But the answer has to follow. The hero needs to agree to go on the adventure. It's not like he's going against his will. There is this verbal contract that needs to be closed, and he does it almost on impulse. And it's because he overhears the dwarves kind of wondering if he is really the burglar that they need, and that's when he steps forward and says, you know, hey, I can do this. I will do this. And then probably immediately all the alarms of his Baggins side of the family go off, and he's like, what am I saying? What am I doing here? But then he has already agreed to go. And I love that moment of the decision that I want to go. And I'm kind of unleashing. It's as if he's awakened from that dormant state where nothing changes. Even over generations, nothing changes. And in that respect, his life is also gaining depth. Because it's a very boring life in the Shire. It would be boring for us as readers. But also for himself. I mean, yes, everything is comfortable, and every day resembles the other, and you've got your food and your comfort. But what is that really the quality of life that you deserve, or is there something more? And I love that, because I think it's a very important message that Tolkien introduces here right from the get-go. It's like, are you content with your day-to-day comfortable life, you know, where every day resembles the other? You've got your job, you've got your home, you've got your food, or are we called to do something different with our life? Are we called to adventure, to help out? Because that's basically what he's doing. He's going to help these dwarves. And is there a greater treasure to be gained than the one that you currently have? And so I think that there's a kind of a almost a meta dimension to this call to adventure. It's in terms of what does Tolkien want to communicate here? It's very similar to what you see in a lot of other stories and also allegories. This is not an allegory, of course, but it's this you know, there you can only your life will only gain depth, and you will only acquire riches if you invest in it, if you dare to step out of your comfortable world. And right. The dwarves, in a way, have had that same conversion, because we hear in the story that the dwarves tell and sing about that they too were very comfortable. They had amassed this great treasure. I mean, just through hard work, of course. But they had all these, you know, jewels and gold and whatnot. And so there was no need for them to evolve or move forward. And it's in their life too. It is from an outside party, in this case, Smaug, that their life is also shaken and stirred, and everything changes because the dragon takes away their treasure, and so they have to reconquer it. But I was amazed to see how much actually this both of the journeys, both the Hobbit journey, but also the Dwarven journey, are retold here in this first chapter of The Hobbit. And I never noticed that parallel before. And then, of course, there's the journey of the wizard, Gandalf. And Gandalf has a different situation here. He's kind of the middleman or the mediator between the two. And again, as a mediator, that too is kind of an archetype in the story. You need someone who brings together these two unlikely parties, because you've got the dwarves and you've got the hobbits, and both of them have very different backgrounds, different cultures, different ideals also in life. But Gandalf is the one who actually puts them together and seems to be quite decisive also. Because at one point, the dwarves are, of course, you know, Bilbo is so not the hero yet that he stumbles and he makes mistakes, and he shows how much he's not prepared to go with them. And then the dwarves start complaining and doubting, and then Gandalf is like, well, hold on. I tell you that this is the guy that we need. This is the hobbit that you need. So why do you doubt? And I was surprised to see that insistence of Gandalf. He's almost unwilling to budge and to enter a dialogue. He's like, you just take my word for it. I am Gandalf. I'm telling you, this is the hobbit. And I'm always right.
Yes, despite ample evidence that this is not the right person
exactly.
for this job.
But isn't that interesting how yes. Gandalf is the only person in the first chapter who sees the potential, and not just judges on the basis of the outside, you know, the given situation, but he is able to see beyond what
right.
the current situation is and see what this hobbit can become. And perhaps he sees that he knows about the history of Bilbo.
What's fascinating about this, I love this because this gives me an opportunity to bring some of the Silmarillion into this discussion. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that they touch on a little bit in The Lord of the Rings at the end and in the appendix, but also that's touched on in the final chapter of the published Silmarillion, which is about the Third Age and the Rings of Power, is what we find is that, for starters, the wizards, when they were sent across the sea, are sent by the Lords of the West, by the Valar, who are the, you know, sort of godlike beings mm-hmm. out in the West. The wizards are sent over to contest the will of Sauron, but in particular, not to fight him directly, but to inspire elves and men and all other free creatures to deeds of valor, and basically to inspire these beings to take up the fight for themselves. And Gandalf in particular, we see is especially faithful to this role, and that he is actually, it's revealed at the end of The Lord of the Rings, and also in this chapter, The Silmarillion, it's a little more explicit. Mm-hmm. It's revealed that he actually possesses one of the three elven rings.
Right.
And he possesses Narya, the Ring of Fire, which, you know, conjures images of fire and spirit and motivation. Mm-hmm. And that really, that's the role we see him taking here and taking throughout The Lord of the Rings as well, that he really fulfills this role that he's been given of moving other people to great deeds. And I mean, it's especially clear here, because here he shoves this completely docile and almost dormant hobbit into mm-hmm. this great adventure that really gets the ball rolling in terms of the eventual defeat of Sauron. And in some of the appendices of Lord of the Rings, we see that indeed he actually is responsible not just for the dwarves happening to show up at Bilbo's doorstep and then, you know, sort of shoving Bilbo out the door to go do it, but he actually is, you know, somewhat responsible for planting the whole idea in Thorin's mind. They actually had a chance meeting in Bree, mm-hmm. and Gandalf, mentions to Thorin, you know, like, hey, I've been thinking about you, and Smaug, and Thorin's like, oh, I was thinking about you too, and Gandalf sort of helps Thorin come to this decision that he needs to leave his comfortable forges and his sort of quiet life and and go after this dragon, which is completely ludicrous. And it's a fascinating role that Gandalf plays, and he really and we find out that that's his job. His job is to go around and essentially, you know, the way the Shire folk see it is go around and stir up trouble, which is certainly one way to see it. But another way to see it is that his job is to go around and inspire folks to something different than their current life, and to go out and achieve, you know, pursue goals that seem to be out of their reach, and then achieve them.
And you know, there was another detail that struck me for the first time while rereading this, and that is that actually there are even bigger things going on that Gandalf seems to know all about, and there's this one piece of dialogue where he tells the dwarves basically, just focus on the treasure and on the dragon. That's enough for you guys right now. So you don't need to know the bigger picture. That's going to be too much on your plate. Just do this treasure thing, and then we'll talk, you know. And so it implies that Gandalf talks from a totally different perspective, and he's got a much wider view of the ultimate storyline of Middle Earth as a whole. And in a way, it's amazing that this was the first book that Tolkien wrote, because we know, of course, that Tolkien later on went to develop this whole backstory, and we actually get to discover this much bigger picture, where the story of the Hobbit almost seems trivial. It's about some gold. It's about a dragon. The only really important element that will actually weigh on the future of Middle Earth is this ring that is almost a kind of a gimmick in this first book, and so I love that, how the ultimate perspective of the story is still hidden from us, but Gandalf already knows, and so in a way, having that bigger picture, you can and you should have confidence that he knows more than you, and so he knows how to judge the different characters for what they're really worth, and in perspective of the role that they will play in the bigger picture.
Yep.
There's much more to say about that, so I'm certainly not done. And gosh, just one thing I discovered while reading the genesis of this first chapter, I didn't know that. Did you know that originally Tolkien wanted Gandalf to be one of the dwarves? So Gandalf
really?
Was a dwarven name, and guess what the name of the wizard was in the first draft? It was Bledorthin. I'm so glad he went with Gandalf.
And that's like how Aragorn began as a hobbit named Trotter. He really his naming improved vastly.
Yeah, I want to talk about that next time that we continue our analysis. But right now, it's time to wrap up this episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit. We might skip a couple of days, or at least one recording next week, because I will be in Spain together with about between 1 million and 2 million other young Catholics for the World Youth Day with Pope Benedict. So I'll be busy walking around there. But when I'm back, I'm eager to continue our analysis of the book. And of course, we invite you to let us know your thoughts. Go to our website, go to our Facebook page, let us know what you think, and post a review on iTunes if you have some time. And that wraps it up. Thanks, Dave. Thanks to our listeners, and see you soon. And may the hair on your feet grow always bigger, or something.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.
What was it again?